This is Astir, talking music with writers and writing with musicians, hosted by me, Carly Brogan, and Joshua James Amberson.
Carly.
Joshua.
I've been thinking a lot about God glitter. Yeah, I just read our guest, Chelsea Beaker, her new novel, Godshot. And there's a lot of things I really love about it. It was such a great book, but the main character is in a cultish church in the kind of, what is that, like the Central Valley of California? And it's a pretty, there's a lot of like low budget theatrics involved in the church. And one of them is what they call God glitter. And it like at just kind of like real, you know, like hallelujah moments that, that the reverend's daughter will sprinkle
like sitting up in the rafters,
glitter from the rafters down on them covertly, and so there's always God glitter raining down, and I just really like that. And I don't want to be in a cult, but I do want God glitter raining down, you know. I just like would like to just like have like glitter like falling from the sky at random times in my life. Just, you know, like just kind of like to break the monotony in a certain way, you know. I just like I appreciate low budget theatrics.
I do too. And what makes it even like more exciting is the characters in this book who attend this church don't even know that it's being sprinkled down from the rafters by the daughter. They think it actually is coming from God, and that's even more exciting to me.
Yeah. Oh, me too. Yeah. I would, I mean, I would love unexplained glitter.
I wish I could believe
glitter
like that, you know?
Yeah.
Like believe in some sort of magic, like all the way.
Yeah.
Ugh, I'm just too much of a skeptic.
Yeah. Yeah. There's disadvantages to being skeptical. Yeah. It's not as fun.
Yeah. It's not as fun. That's
right.
True.
Yeah. How do you know Chelsea Beaker or her work?
The first time I heard of Chelsea Beaker, she was reading at, it may have been the Unchaste Readers, Unchaste Reader series, reading series.
One of those.
Yeah, it's a, yeah, one of those. It's called something like that. I've read at it before. It was a reading series put on by Jenny Forrester. It was awesome. Anyway, I believe that's where I first saw her read. But when I really got into her, which is more recently, I read a story she wrote for Granta magazine in 2018 called Cowboys and Angels. And it was it's her voice. Just
amazing voice. Yeah.
She has such an amazing voice. Like from the get-go, I was hooked. Yeah, and so after that I was looking forward to buying Godshot. I've read that, I love it, and I can say I'm a fan.
Yeah, and Godshot came out just a few months ago. I don't actually know the exact release date offhand, but came out a few months ago on Catapult Books, local press here in Portland. And yeah, and you and another one of our friends in our writing group just raved about this book so much that I was really excited to read it. And then when you came on as a co-host recently, I was just like, I mean, it seems like we should invite Chelsea because you were so excited about her book. And so you let me borrow her book, and I read it this week and really enjoyed it. And I really loved so much about it, but the sentences just really grabbed me, you know, where it's just like a very fun and just kind of unique prose style that I'm not like looking at it and kind of picking out influences. I'm just seeing it as its its kind of own animal. And yeah. like, and that's, and I really love that, where I just feel like she's like, you know, not only honed her voice, but just like has her own way of coming to a sentence and yeah. dealing with it. And for that's sure. really exciting. So yeah, we're going to talk to her about Godshot, and also we're going to talk to about the Granta story, Cowboys and Angels. That is the title story of an upcoming short story collection.
Yeah.
Issues, that is done and will come out in the future. And she did something really cool with the playlist that she sent to us, in that it's all songs that are kind of the soundtrack to these books.
Yeah.
Like, they're not, you know, they're all, they're not like necessarily personal songs, you know. Most of the time writers that we have on bring songs that are like, that they want to like talk about as like kind of like personal influences in their life.
Right.
So, but like, this was like all about the characters' lives.
Yeah. And like, that's what it is.
You know, and it's like, and it's about, there's like these like really like these set pieces for the books themselves. And like, you just like, in the like, movie adaptations, like these would be the
yes.
these would be the songs like playing at like really like decisive moments. And so I really love yeah. that she did something different with her playlist yeah. and that it's like all based on the work.
Oh, you just gave me, this would make the Godshot would make such a good movie.
Oh yeah.
It needs to be a movie.
Yeah,
if anybody's listening to this that has that power, please do that.
Yeah, yeah. I second that. Yeah. It would be fuck, man.
Reverend yeah. Vern in yeah. his like cheap velvet robe. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I yeah. need to see this.
Yeah. All right. Well, I'm excited about this movie.
Yeah, me
this
too.
This movie Let's adaptation go. Of Chelsea's book, and maybe we'll bring it up and, you know,
yeah.
see if she's worked see if on she's the down. Screenplay.
Yeah. yeah.
All right, Chelsea Beaker Steer.
I'm wondering, like, what is it like to put out a book during a pandemic when you would presumably be on a book tour? How has the pandemic affected, like, touring and readings and all of that?
Yeah, it's so interesting because prior to the pandemic, I was very concerned with, you know, leaving my young children for the first time for kind of an extended time. I have never mm-hmm. done that. And so all of my preparation was really geared toward this big reveal of independence after, you know, being with yeah. small children for years and years and not really ever, you know, it would be my first time on an airplane by myself. So I was nervous wow. about that, but also very excited. And I had finally kind of come to the point where I was like, I can do it. I'm ready. And then the opposite really happened. So now it feels like I've doubled down with being with them more than ever and like, and having absolutely no independence. So it's kind of funny how that worked, but it's certainly not what I could have ever dreamed up in any of my anxiety, you know, spiral dreams of what could have gone wrong. I was not thinking yeah. there would be a pandemic. So it was just an altering of reality. And then really like a practice of acceptance, because it felt like kind of every day as things were being canceled, we were all just learning every day what it meant to be in a pandemic, and we still are. But mm-hmm. yeah, I just sort of finally was like, okay, it's not going to happen. I'm probably not going to have in-person events. And so how can I you know, lean into doing as much as I can online. And I've been amazed with booksellers and readers and just how much people have come together on the internet to celebrate books coming out and to have reading groups and book clubs and all the creative ways that I've still been able to connect with people. So that's been really beautiful.
Yeah, totally. And it actually makes it maybe more accessible for some people who maybe don't want to, like, even before pandemic, don't want to, like, go out. Or maybe it's people that live in a different state and they wouldn't have been able to attend otherwise. So, I mean, I guess you have to look for those silver linings.
Definitely.
Yeah, I haven't gone to as many online readings as I've liked. But the ones I have gone to, I've been so impressed with kind of the numbers, for one, of people tuning in, and also from all the different places people mm-hmm. are coming from. And yeah, and talking to some friends here in Portland who have disabilities or anxiety issues and just don't or can't go out to events have been actually really excited that so much has been happening online, and really, like, you know, so there's just like all these things that I think I didn't think about before, that online events are actually, yeah, there is a silver lining, and there's, you know, a ton of people that it really kind of works out better for as well. So true.
It's interesting. You mentioned part of your anxiety about traveling and touring that you eventually reckoned with was leaving your children behind, and, you know, seeing your role as a mother. So the anxiety that you had about going on tour was leaving your children behind. And I see you as this mother figure, even just on social media, pictures with your children. And would you mind talking a little bit about the role mothers and mother loss has in your life?
Oh, yeah, it's huge. I mean, and as my kids have gotten older, I've uncovered even more ways that, you know, I think my own experience growing up with a really difficult childhood, as far as my own mother, you know, leaving when I was young, I think it has created some sense in me that, you know, I want to cling to my kids, and that leaving them would not really work out, or that something bad would happen in my absence. And, you know, all those worries, mm-hmm. I feel like I really have to look deeper into those and see the ways in which, you know, my childhood is creating those fears more than the reality of their situation. And I definitely, as a mother, was really, you know, stunned by how hard it would be for me to relinquish control to other people to watch them, you know? And yeah. It's easy before you have kids to imagine what you'll be like as a parent, but then in the moment, feeling like, you know, for mothers, I think anxiety is just sort of a staple where it's accepted, like, oh, well, you're just scared because you're a new mom. Like, that's yeah. normal. But there is a line, and I've had to tread that line and really inquire, you know, is my fear something that's legitimate, or is it something I can work with and look deeper into? And that was part of this, where it's like, I would never, you know, want to do something that would ever put them at risk. But at the same time, like, me being an artist and having independence is not that thing. So, you know, just reckoning with that and knowing that it's good for them to see me in the world doing those things. But yeah, it's incredibly hard for me to feel safe enough to relinquish that control.
Yeah.
You know, so that's just like a daily thing. But it's funny because now I never really had to face it completely. I never had to like get on that plane. So now right. I'll have to kind of reorient at a later time. I think it's just because my son is super young and he's still he's barely two. So he's at that age where, you know, they're walking off of cliffs if you let them. Like, there's no, you know, they're just so accident prone. So there's a lot of you know, even when I'm standing right next to him, he falls. So I'm like, yeah. Someone else won't know him the way I do. And, you know,
yeah, won't know when he's about to fall.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And how old is your daughter?
She's just turned 6.
Okay.
So,
yeah.
You know, but I think being a mother myself, going back to, I think what was really the question maybe you were asking is, you know, my own mother loss, it really informs everything about how I mother and the ways in which I think I see this new generation and also myself as like as cycle breakers and doing things differently and trying to heal the pain of the past and also have this future that doesn't have to go through so much suffering because of what I've learned. So, you know, always leaning into learning more about how to be a good mom and kind of subvert some of the patterns I had growing up. It's probably what we're all doing, really.
Yeah, I like that so much. Yeah, I like that idea.
Do you feel that this is your, like, your writing obsession? And by that, I mean, I think all of us writers have our thing that we're working out and our thing that we write. For me, it's addiction. And it's like everything I write somehow is colored by those experiences, whether I'm talking about them directly or indirectly. And I was just reading one of my friends who's a writer and has a book coming out, has written several pieces about the suicide of a schoolmate that happened back. She didn't even really know him that well. He was like a loose friend.
Are you talking about Candace Opper?
Yeah, I'm talking about Candace Opper. Yeah. And she, you know, talks about how that's sort of her upset, you know, what she writes about. And so, in reading things like Cowboys and Angels and the Mother Loss piece that was in Lit Hub and your book, Godshot, I can see like all the connective threads. And I'm just curious about this catharsis and what all of this has, how it is for you.
Yeah, I think I always knew that my work would probably engage with that sort of loss. Namely, you know, the loss of a parent who doesn't die, but is still alive, just not in the world of the child. So that was something I was always searching for myself to read about, and not something that I found all that often. And it comes back in my work. You know, I think this book with Godshot is really the heart of what I felt, sort of that emotional experience growing up. And once I finished that book, it's funny because it's like the project I'm working on now is still revolving around motherhood and what it's like to be a mother without a mother yourself, and how that fracture affects the way you parent and the way you see yourself as a mother. It's almost like I've just shifted into a different age bracket where I'm like, maybe I'll just keep exploring mother loss through each age bracket and that'll just be my life's work. You know, looking at it from all these different angles I'm interested in that. It keeps coming in. So I just allow that too.
You should. Yeah. It's so funny though to hear that, because every day in like working on my manuscript right now, I'm like, I swear to God, when this book is done, I am never, ever writing about addiction again. But you know what? That's probably not true. I probably still will.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's just something that we all in our own ways start to see when, you know, writing for long, you know, like many years or decades, you know, that like that a single, what is seemingly a single subject can just be like an entry point into the world, you know, that it's every topic can like in its own way connect to everything else. And that, you know, what might seem like a repetition is just kind of an access point to getting to bigger subjects or many subjects, or, you know, so I don't really see our individual obsessions as writers being limiting, you know, like it's all just in my mind, just an access point to like getting to everything.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I was curious, reading Godshot, what do you have any personal relationship or experience with cults or just like hardcore religion?
Not with cults per se. I definitely wasn't in a tiny rural, you know, extreme religious cult growing up, but I was in, I grew up in the church for part of my childhood. So when I moved in with my grandparents around age 9, I was kind of immediately in the Christian church because they were. So, so my life took a real turn. I went from nothing as far as faith or religion to being quite involved in the church and staying there for years. And so it's a big part of my upbringing. And then I think there is that adult grappling with whatever religion you were raised in and the natural way that we then question or we interrogate those beliefs often as adults, or we look back and we think, oh, that shaped my view of sex, my body, all these things that ultimately for me, I think my experience left more of a question mark for me, where it was like, things just weren't talked about that should have been talked about. And what filled that hole was shame. So yeah. It wasn't always that overtly abusive or negative things were being said within the church I grew up in, but it was more just sort of this void of nothing that then, of course, as young people, we fill with all the, well, I did. I filled with all the wrong ideas about myself that were probably not true, and I had to unpack that later as an adult. But I was always fascinated with when you... if you're so entrenched in a faith or a belief system, you know, often the narratives I find of it are about this sort of black and white turning from it. So we go from full faith to no faith. And that was never quite the experience I had, where it was sort of like more of just a question mark. I just wanted to find more. I wanted to learn more. I wasn't shutting doors, but I just felt like I was always opening other doors. So,
ooh, I like that.
I wanted the character to have a faith journey that maybe didn't end in just non-belief, but ended in something else. So that was kind of my aim with Godshot. And then the cult influence was more just a personal fascination. I was really interested in the Children of God cult, that their literature is really interesting, especially in the ways they used women in the church to convert people, and that was fascinating. And then I was interested in kind of physical manifestations of the spirit in various healing churches. So there was some early reading about those things. And then the research kind of stopped and imagination took over, but I was interested initially in some of those cults.
Part of what I love about your writing is that you do this thing that I wouldn't call it absurd. You know, it's not in the fantastical, but it's like these, it's a strangeness that you pepper in everything that you write. And I'm like in Godshot with like the mention of like canned scorpion meat and these like cola, generic cola baptisms, and the guy that paints lawns. And then like in Cowboys and Angels, you talk, once the cowboy in that story rubs peanut butter on his abdomen. It's just like these moments that are surprising and weird. And I totally love it. Do you want to talk more about that?
Sure. I mean, all I can say is that I love those moments in when I read fiction that feel so highly specific that they could never be anywhere else. And I know that we've all experienced that when reading, when you're just like, oh, what an image. I've just never thought of something that way, or I've never seen that before. And immediately that connects me to the story when I read, and it creates such a memorable reading experience. Yeah. And I think I love that as a reader. And then as a writer, I always, and it's also something I do in revision, I think too, is going back through and thinking, what have I written here that is familiar or common, and then questioning it, you know, with descriptions or or anything, dialogue too, you know, is this something the reader will just zone out on because it's expected? And often that comes first. It's like we're writing a conversation, maybe it's not that exciting, but then in revision we have this great time to go back and really question all of our choices and make them, you know, what's right underneath that layer. There's usually something more interesting. So I like to do that with images. And writing this book, I think the landscapes are so bleak, the situation is so bleak. There was a real monochrome quality to the land and the place and the people. And so really I wanted to infuse it with some bright, contrasting, obscure, and kind of bizarre adornments and color. And these people are really interested in being shiny and bright, and they're really searching for some joy amidst all that bleakness, which is just human nature, I think. So
yeah, totally, I get that. Like the turquoise cowboy. And it seems like if we're going to compare this story to, or this book to Cowboys and Angels, both kind of have these flamboyant, colorfully dressed cowboys at the center of them, which made me curious, you know, what their symbolism means to you. But they definitely, it does, like their presence makes the book so much weirder, and like, I just love it, or makes the stories weirder.
Thank you. Yeah, the cowboys, you know, the Central Valley of California is, there's quite a population of cowboys there. I don't know if people know that. It's a real agricultural epicenter. And so there's kind of a subculture there that's very Southern, very rooted in, you know, some people call it the Bible Belt of California. And I like those images contrasting with what people assume about California, which is usually not that. Usually it has something to do with surfing or the beach, but I'm like, well, not where I grew up, you know?
Yeah. Is that where you grew up?
It is. Yeah, I grew up there.
And was it outside of the Fresno area, like the setting of Godshot, or is it off from that?
It is. It's a fiction. Peaches is not a real town. It's a fictional town, but I was modeling it a little bit from some of the rural areas that exist, these tiny rural farming areas that aren't really on the map outside of Fresno, you know, maybe 30 miles away. And that was sort of like the imagery, but it's definitely a fictionalized town. I wanted the freedom to make it what I wanted it to be at the same time.
Yeah. I kind of assumed it was a fictionalized town, but I kind of didn't want to look it up, you know, I didn't want to check, you know, I just wanted to assume that this was, you know, a place that is in a specific location. Like we kind of know its relative, you know, distance to Fresno, and which is a place like I'm familiar with just from, you know, being in California a lot and driving around and passing through those areas. So I kind of had a sense of, you know, where it was, but I was like, and so it was very grounded, you know, as a fictional town, but I was like, I just want to believe that this is like a lost town outside of Fresno.
Yeah.
Yeah, you definitely did, like, the world building you did is, I wanted to talk to you a little bit about that, because I know with myself, with writing, I make these playlists that kind of maybe go back to the era that I'm writing about. Like, for example, right now, I'm, like, writing stuff that takes place in the 90s, so I've been listening to a lot of 90s music to kind of put me in that mode. And in listening to your playlist, I could see what these songs did to sort of enrich in the stories. Like, even if some of these songs aren't literally in Godshot or in Cowboys and Angels, they're there, like their presence is felt. It sort of reminds me of like what music, like when we develop fictional characters, they're like these hollow things and we have to fill them with real life, and part of that can be like the music that would have been around them or the music they listened to. And I guess I just want you to talk a little bit about how you work, if you listen to music while you work, if that helps inspire the writing. And yeah.
Yeah. I don't often, I can't have music on too loud with lyrics. I think that's probably similar to a lot of writers. It just would feel a little too intrusive to sort of the natural things I'm hearing. You know, I like to be able to hear. But these songs, occasionally I will write with music, especially in the early drafts, or just, I love that energy that can come if you can really get in the flow with the music playing and also the flow of typing at the same time. Mm-hmm. You know, some of these songs felt like that it was more of this essence of them that felt so connected to this land and so connected to the way I saw these characters. And so, yeah, this list is really, in each song, I would say there's an essence of mainly the main character or one of the characters that feels so specific and so close. And some of the songs are mentioned in the novel. So yeah, I just love the energy that music can translate into our own writing. And I included the song Outlaws on the list by Joe Purdy, because that's probably the biggest example of when a song really influenced a story directly, where I listened to those lyrics and they're such a story in and of themselves if you listen to it. You know, and then I wrote the story Cowboys and Angels, where I felt like I just felt so inspired by the story and the song and just wanted to like dig deeper into some of the essences that I was feeling from those people from the song. So I would say that's probably the only time I've done that so directly, but that's why I put it on the list.
Maybe let's just listen to a minute of that.
One more drink for a split town, pulled up in a rose pink Cadillac. He was singing with the top down girl from the north, Dylan and Johnny Cash. He won a car on a card game, listening to the boss that keeps his clothes in a gunny sack. She said, tell you what, sailor, if you take me out of here, I'll do anything that you ask. Cause I don't wanna die like the people down here, but I feel that I'm fading fast. He looked over to a chestnut hair, he said, I don't believe in love. But he knew good and well she was the only girl there, so he figured it was close enough. And I hopped in the car, rolled the windows down far, and they headed through the desert plains. And she didn't even mind when they crossed the state line and the sky opened up with rain. And they went three states before they even spoke a word. He leaned over just to ask her name. She said, take me to the 61 Highway, sailor, and you can call me Queen Jane. Cause the only thing I stole from the town was a crown that I took from a beauty queen. He looked over to her deep green eyes, knew that she was just as cold as him. So he went to the trunk, grabbed the pistol from the side, and told Janie of his plan.
So you're saying that one led pretty directly to the Granta story that we've talked about a couple times, Cowboys and Angels, right? And that story really feels like a precursor to Godshot, that it's like, you know, in many ways very different and in many ways has a lot of overlap at the same time. Is there a relationship between the two stories or kind of?
Yeah, I think the relationship is sort of this place that started existing for me in a very real way through the writing of the novel and also that story and then the collection of stories that's coming out in 2022, where I was really writing them at the same time. So a lot of the characters kind of overlap. there is some indirect connections, I think, between the environment, especially, and then the people and then what you would find there. So writing Cowboys and Angels was an interesting experience where it felt like probably the most channeled of anything I've ever written, where it just felt like it came out like that. Like that first paragraph was exactly, really wasn't altered much in revision from the first paragraph I started writing. I mean, that doesn't happen all that often for me, but with that one, it did. And something about it felt like this voice was just so, so specific and wanted to say something. So that one was kind of an interesting experience.
Yeah. And so you were saying that the novel and the story were happening simultaneously. How long did you, when did Godshot start? Maybe that's the question I'm interested in. Like, what, how long ago was that?
I started writing that story. The very beginning was probably in 2013. And then, and the stories were already existing. So actually Godshot kind of started in a way as a story and then kind of bled out from there. And I realized it was going to be something a lot longer. But prior to that, I had been writing short stories that were circling some of the same themes, some of the same places. And then I felt like I zeroed in on something that was bigger eventually. But I continued writing short fiction almost as a means of escaping Godshot. When I felt like I was coming up to a block or I just needed a break, I would, you know, shift to writing a story. So in a way they, you know, they feel connected in terms of their kind of artistic heartbeat.
Yeah. Would you maybe want to read a little bit for us?
Sure. I'd love to.
Great.
I'm going to read a moment where the main character of Godshot, Lacey May, is meeting this lawn painter that Carly mentioned earlier. She's seeing him for the second time and they're having an encounter. When I got back to Cherry's, I wanted to tell her of my realization. I wanted to celebrate and dance, the grape juice still on my tongue. But Cherry wasn't out on the porch looking at her grass. It was Stringy, the lawn painter from Popcorn, Indiana, sweating on her rocker, a box of stone chinchillas under one arm. No one answered, so I figured I'd wait, he said. See how you liked my little present. He looked out over the lawn, which was still a neon green shout. I went inside and brought him out a cup of warm soda. His lopsided smile was simple. There was nothing behind it, I decided. I love it, I said. I could still feel Vern's finger on my lip, the salt of his skin mixed with the sweet of the grapes, but I liked hearing Stringy talk. On and on he went about nothing, his care so small. I liked how he looked at me, like I amused him, like he'd never known a girl in all his life. Let me get your number, he said. I'll take you out sometime. I told him I didn't have a phone, but he said that everyone had a phone. I held my hands out empty. I told him how Cherry didn't like the house line tied up in case she wanted to play telephone testimony, calling up randoms from the phone book and trying to convert them through an even lecture of terror and love. He nodded like he understood and then made a remark about how I wasn't wearing the bikini today. You're not in the green elf suit, I said back. Instead, he was freshly shaven, a few spots of dried blood on his cheek, where a razor had sheared the heads off pimples. His eyes were wrinkled around the corners, but his body was all boy, skinny in his black t-shirt and black sagged shorts, white socks pulled up mid-calf. He didn't dress like a country boy, like the boys of Peaches with their faded jean cutoffs, soiled white shirts that came from a 10-pack. His shirt said Blink 182. And had a picture of a harshly pretty nurse who I strongly suspected wasn't really a nurse, pulling a blue glove over her tattooed arm. I wondered if this was the type of woman Stringy wanted to be with, someone with angles of makeup drawn on, breasts pushed up until they kissed. I couldn't help but feel that she had taken whatever sexiness I might have had and canceled it out with her own. You found God? It came from my mouth like the deepest routine. He looked me up and down, side smiling. I found you. I'll stop there.
Oh, I love it.
Yeah, thank you so much. Yeah.
I had to pull in Blink-182 considering the podcast.
Yeah. I'm glad you did that. And I can just see this guy. Like, it's so good. There were so many moments just when you were reading right now where I just was like laughing so hard and remembering just parts of the book, like these names you come up with of characters and these their weird, strange hobbies and their jobs. I mean, all of it is so just, it's great.
Yeah, the specificity of so much in Godshot is just really, was just really exciting to me. And like, the, what was it, telephone testimony?
Yeah.
In the last excerpt, that things like that, that I just really loved and held on to. And I feel like you just kind of packed the book with that in this way that like was just so exciting as a reader to experience. You know, that was just like, there's just like so many things to like, so many like surprises and treats along the way. Yeah, maybe it's time to listen to some Blink though.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Yeah.
It was a Friday night, I woke alone to get the feeling right. We started making out and she took off my pants, but then I turned on the TV, and that's about the time she walked away from me. Nobody likes you when you're 23, and I saw more of my TV shows. What the hell is ADD? My friends say I should act my age. What's my age again? What's my age again?
I'd actually kind of forgotten what Blink-182 sounded like until this. And when you sent the playlist, I was like, I know all these songs, but I'm actually not going to listen to it because there's so many that I haven't heard for a long time that I'm like, want to be surprised by them. And I was very surprised, even though I admittedly listened to that album so much when it came out that I was like, when it came on, I was like, oh yeah, this is what this band sounds like. They'd kind of become like just kind of like symbol of themselves,
right,
or something for me. Yeah. 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 What's your was that just like very specific for this type of guy, or did you have a relationship with the band itself?
Well, at one point, I'm sure I would have wished that I had had a relationship with the band itself. you know, I don't know, like growing up, it was just that when I think about like what I was blasting in my car in high school, it was often Blink-182. I felt like I just loved them. I can't explain it any other way. I felt like it sort of represented this way in which the music itself feels a little bit like jumpy and a little rebellious, and it has an energy to it that feels like I'm going to cause some trouble. And I think it was sort of like, for me, I didn't have a lot of musical influence coming in from my household, and so I was picking up on whatever people around me, peers and stuff, were listening to, and that those were my peers were listening to Blink-182 and, you know, bands like Good Charlotte and all of those kind of like punky-ish bands that I don't know if they were cool or not, but in Fresno in 2003, you know, that's what we were listening to. So in writing this, I think I pictured this character as having this connection to those types of bands and in a way, and that's kind of where he finds some identity amid in a place that is definitely not the identity. So for him there, it feels really alternative, you know, to be dressed like that or to have such a such an image on his shirt is not what she's used to seeing at all. So, you know, it feels scandalous to her, I think.
Right.
It did so much work to have that the Blink-182 t-shirt, like not just in painting his character, but yeah, like showing us a time and a place and being symbolic for like the youth, like the, you know, this is a book that is largely dealing with young people, and you have the young people that are in the church, and then you have like pitted against that, you have the young people that are the ones going down and hanging out and drinking beers and all that. And so it just really like, it just does so. And even the fact that Lacey May like considers this nurse image on the shirt in terms of her own sexuality, like it just, this one little image just does so much stuff for the book or for that moment.
Yeah. And I think this is also, this character Stringy is a man that's never really grown up. So he's in a way like he's, you know, what's my age again? It's sort of spot on.
But right.
Yeah.
He, what is his age? It's definitely right. Too old to be talking to this young girl. I'll say that.
Yeah. Yeah. For sure. Yeah.
And then sharing a baby mattress with her, yeah. Her grandmother's house.
I'm glad you both seem amused by those details and not offended, or, you know, I think some readers are like, oh my God.
Really? But
for me, that's funny. For me, those are the humorous points of the book where they're tragically funny. Of course, they're not, they're dark, but to me, they're really funny. So.
Yeah. I wanted to talk, that the last song on the playlist, the Nina Simone song, Ain't Got No, I Got Life. I've actually never heard that song before, though I've heard a lot of Nina Simone. And I just loved this song, how it's like uplifting and human and like very childish even in a really like funny. There's just something about it. I've never heard anything like it. And I'm curious as to why it's on your list and what relationship you have with the song.
Yeah, I love this song. I think for all the reasons you just named, but also, you know, there's something so resilient about it.
I ain't got no home, ain't got no shoes, ain't got no money, ain't got no class, ain't got no skirts, ain't got no sweater, ain't got no perfume. Ain't got no bed, ain't got no mind. Ain't got no mother, ain't got no culture, ain't got no friends, ain't got no schooling, ain't got no love, ain't got no name, ain't got no ticket, ain't got no token, ain't got no God. And what about my hair, got my head, got my brains, got my ears, got my eyes, got my nose, got my mouth, I got my smile, I got my tongue, got my chin, got my neck, got my boots, got my heart, got my soul, got my back, I got my sex, I got my arms, got my hands, got my fingers, got my legs, got my feet, got my toes, got my liver, got my blood, I've got life, I got my freedom, I've got life, I've got life, and I'm gonna keep it, I've got life, and nobody's gonna take it away.
There remains this resiliency that is really inhabited within her body that remains despite all of the externals. You know, she doesn't have a mother. She doesn't have culture. She doesn't have friends. She doesn't have school. But, and then she goes on this long list of all the things she does have. And and it's all the things that are within her and that can't be changed by someone else. So there's such a resiliency there. And it's really a beautiful song. And I think it was made even more beautiful after I played it for my daughter one day, and she just glommed onto it like I've never seen her to a song, and she loved it, and she sings it, and she always like is humming it. And I was interested in how, you know, children respond to music. They're just sponges. So, and she just really heard a spirit in that song. I could tell that was very memorable. You know, mostly she listens to the Moana soundtrack. And then this was like, you know, Moana part two with, you know, this sort of feminist messaging. And she really loved it. And it kind of reminded me how much I always love the song too. So, and I think the spirit of Lacey May in the book too is that so much is taken from her, almost everything. And so she's subject to so much of this systemic violence that exists in her town and in this cult and society, and yet there remains a real resilience with her and the way that she continues on. So felt like it had a place on this list.
I really love that connection. And the other ones I saw more directly, and I really love what you did with your playlist, having it all connect to the work, you know, that it was, that's like in some way part of the atmosphere of Godshot and your short stories. And and one thing I really love about Nina Simone is that you can listen to so much Nina Simone, like you were saying, Carly, and then hear a song and be like, oh, I've never heard this Nina Simone song, and it's amazing. I feel like I have that happen several times every year, you know, like that I'll, in at least in normal times, you know, be in a coffee shop or something and be like, what is this Nina Simone song? Like, where did this come from? Yeah, right. And she's
an
just
endless.
It's just like, in, catalog. I really like feel that there's just like an endless, you know, supply, this endless back catalog of an amazing Nina Simone songs you've never heard somehow. And I just really love that about her work, is just like, yeah, that you can be surprised by her over and over again.
Another song that feels really like resilient on this list and kind of tough is and maybe we should listen to a little bit of it first, but Fancy, Reba McEntire.
Summer I turned 18. We lived in a one-room rundown shack on the outskirts of New Orleans. We didn't have money for food or rent, to say the least. We were hard-pressed. Then Mama spent every last penny we had to buy me a dancing dress. Well, Mama washed and combed and curled my hair, and she painted my eyes and lips. Then I stepped into a satin dancing dress that had a split from the side clean up to my hip. It was red velvet trimming and it fitting me good. Standing back from the looking glass, there stood a woman where a half-grown kid had stood. She said, here she wants his fancy, don't let me down. She said, here she wants his fancy, don't let me down.
Yeah, when I was listening to the playlist yesterday, I just, that Fancy song just made me feel like I remembered the scene in the book where she's in the car. I don't even know if this, the song might even be in the scene, I'm not sure, but it's where she's driving off with the women from the sex telephone operator place, and I can't think of their names right now, but it just has this sort of like driving towards the horizon, free kind of feel that I love it.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah,
it's such a like power, you know, like in control kind of kind of jam.
Almost a Thelma and Louise kind of.
Yeah, exactly. Song. The vibe I was thinking.
Yeah.
Well, you did mention, and I didn't know about this, but that you have a short story collection
in the works,
or a schedule, or has a estimated published date and release date. And tell us a little about that.
So the collection is right now, I suppose it could change, it's called Cowboys and Angels, and it was sold at the same time as the novel. So it's pretty, I mean, it's done in the way that a book could be done. and we're sort of probably going to start editing soon for that. I think it's, we don't have dates pinned down yet. I think it's sort of slated to come out early 2022. But yeah, it's like I was saying, it's definitely a collection that holds the hand of Godshot for sure, where they're indirectly connected through place, through characters. There's some overlapping characters. There's some thematic similarities. But, you know, a lot of the stories are really their own at the same time. But they were written at the same time, so they feel connected to me.
Yeah.
That's great. And yeah, and then maybe talk a little about what you're working on right now.
Yeah, I started, I realized that the kind of heartbeat of this new project I'm working on, I really felt the first little pulses of a couple years ago, but was not really in a place where I was going to explore that. I remember just making some notes or thinking about it and then kind of moving on. But I've really come back to it. And then I did, I wrote it as a short story early in the year, and then immediately felt similar with Godshot. I just had that little feeling where I was like, oh, I love writing in this voice. I think I have a lot more to say here. And so I just started continuing it and really leaning into that. And then I did the 1,000 Words of Summer challenge from the writer Jamie Attenberg. I don't know if you both have seen that on social media, but you haven't. It's really amazing. I've never engaged with it before this year, but she writes these really inspiring and beautiful letters that come in your inbox every day. And she has guest writers come in and write these, essays on their own process. Yeah, you just put your email address in, it comes in every day. And the idea is that you're writing 1,000 words of something every single day for a span of time, I think maybe 2 weeks or something.
Okay.
So I've never done that before. Like, I've never committed in that way, like a word count type of way for a daily practice, but I was like, I'm just going to try it. You know, it's 2020, like anything can happen.
Yeah.
And I actually loved, and it was perfect, I think, for drafting like a first draft of a novel, because I was just coming to the page every day and just letting whatever wanted to come out. But committing to that 1,000 words, and was really surprised when often much more than 1,000 words would come out. And I just kept going with it until I reached the end of this first draft of a new book. So now I'm in the process of just kind of figuring out what I wrote and, digging deep and going back through it and starting that process again. But I feel really excited about this project. It's really deeply about motherhood. It's about all the things that are not really written about very much, that I wish were written about and represented more. Certainly we have some real staple books that we could point to that talk a lot about motherhood, but I think in the fictional sphere, I wanted to find a book that took more of a deep dive into some of the real physical aspects of birth and labor and postpartum, and that I wasn't totally always finding. So that's kind of my goal, is to really make some art out of those details.
Mm. That's great. I mean, I don't think I could think of a fiction book. Actually, when you were describing the project, I was picturing it being nonfiction. Because I feel like typically that's what I'll come across, is like a memoir maybe about childbirth or motherhood and all that. But to make a piece of work that's in the fiction realm that does this, I can't think of anything off the top of my head that does this. So I'm really excited to read it.
Yeah. I mean, I found a few. I don't want to make it sound like I'm some pioneer coming in out of nowhere. certainly there's been beautiful writing about motherhood forever. I think of Afterbirth by Elisa Albert as a book that really doesn't shy away from the postpartum. But I think, you know, in that book, the son is, it spans from newborn to one. And I wanted to go beyond that too, and kind of talk about how, you know, that the postpartum period is so much longer than what people, what our country, especially, well, our country thinks it's 6 weeks, you know, you go in for your 6 week appointment and they're like, okay, you're ready to have sex again. Like, that's actually like why you go in, to make sure that you can have sex again. And nothing else is really discussed.
That surprised me.
That's the standard treatment. I mean, that really is. And it's, I could talk about this for a long time and I won't, because that's not what this podcast is about, but that it's sort of this feeling for me where it's like, I really want to have some tiny part in familiarizing some of those themes in a fictional space where, you know, these terms aren't another language. Like, we can learn about the pelvic floor in a way that, I don't know, I wish I had learned in high school what the pelvic floor was. I doubt anybody else really did.
You know, I didn't learn. No. There's so much I didn't know.
There should be a whole class on your pelvic floor for men and women. It's an amazing bowl of muscles that nobody talks about, but it supports everything. So
this podcast could be about that. You know, it's very
Make it about a pelvic floor. Pelvic floor podcast.
This is the pelvic floor episode. It could be, you know, so
great. The potential's
there. I'm still just reeling over the fact that the 6 week checkup is just to make sure she can have sex again. I mean, that is just so, like, I don't know. It's so patriarchal. It's like, all right, doctor said you're ready to fuck. Like, yeah. I don't know. Ready to make a baby.
And if you can't, well, so up until the pandemic, I was nannying for one of our friends for the last, you know, I don't know, 10 months or something. Mm-hmm. And so I learned a lot of things because I started when the baby was 20 days old and through that period. And that if you can't, the doctor will give you a note to give to your partner to that you have a doctor's note that says you can't have sex yet. So not to like pressure that agenda. That's a common practice, evidently. Still. And when I learned that, I was horrified. I was like what? I mean, it just feels like from such another era, you know? And our friend talked to her sisters and was like, oh yeah, I got the note, you know, like just, you know, like
as if like your husband just can't communicate with you without a doctor's note.
Like, won't believe you without a doctor's note or, you know, like, And I was just like, what world are we in, you know? And I felt very kind of ignorant about, you know, just kind of like the state of the world after learning things like that, you know, that just seemed so archaic to me. Yeah,
that's a great portrait of how it really is and how other cultures, I mean, in some cultures you don't, the mother doesn't even get up for 40 days. I mean, there is no, you are, the mother is just with the baby. They are protected. People are feeding them. I mean, there's nothing here in America. It's like, well, if you're not up and in a swimsuit in, you know, 4 weeks, what's wrong with you? Like, why aren't you back to work yet? To go back to work 6 weeks after you have a newborn is totally insane, in my opinion.
Me too.
Unless the mother, that's truly what she wants. But I mean, just bodily, most cultures would not consider you ready for something like that. And in other countries, they include pelvic floor rehabilitation. That's just part of the package of your care. Here, it's a lot of hoops to jump through. You have to get a doctor's recommendation to go to the physical therapist. You have to have like proof that you need that, which everybody needs that. You know, there's so many things, and then often insurance doesn't cover it. So people just don't do it and they're not checking for problems. But I could go on. It's just a sad state of affairs here in America when it comes to being a woman.
I'm excited to see how this all turns out. And it was so good talking to you. And I'm so glad you wanted to be part of this.
Yeah, it's a wonderful podcast. I love the marriage between the music and the writing. And just having these conversations feels so life-giving right now. So thank you.
This tier is recorded, for now, remotely, from various homes in Portland, Oregon. It can be heard through Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, Player FM, as well as our website. You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook. New episodes come out every 2 weeks. Thanks for joining us.